Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor, producer, writer, and show host extraordinaire, Neil Patrick Harris. When I invited Neil on the show, I was pretty confident we wouldn't run out of things to talk about, but I did worry about how I was going to possibly fit our conversation into just an hour. Neil's been acting in TV and movies since he was 15, has starred on Broadway, and hosted every major award show you can imagine, and won awards for hosting them. He sings, dances, performs magic, and now he's producing, directing, and writing. And not just screenplays, but novels. Neil told me he's always valued career longevity over fame, and hearing his story, I could see why. For 4 years, he was known as Doogie Howser, M.D. The problem was, years after the series ended, he was still known as Doogie Howser, M.D. Figuring out who you are is tough at that age. Doing it in the public eye is almost impossible. Feeling stymied both personally and professionally, he sought help in the last place you'd think someone like him would look. It helped, but as you'll hear, it was 2 stage shows that really freed him as an artist. And that's not the only reason the guy loves theater. Neil calls himself a court jester, but he's realized he has some important things to say. But on the sly, hidden in the wit, hijinks, and sophisticated language of his new kids' book are valuable lessons about honoring what makes us weird. In a funny, honest conversation, Neil shares why his autobiography is a choose-your-own-adventure book, what an East German transgender rock star taught him about self-acceptance, and he reveals his most humiliating stage experience ever. We also ponder why some people need to believe that actors are jerks in real life. If you're one of them, this episode may disappoint you. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Hey, man, my pleasure.
You know, I got a bone to pick with you.
Okay.
You do too much stuff, and it's exhausting for me trying to research to talk to you. I mean,
where do you start?
Right, acting, writing, hosting, executive producing, directing.
Yeah, magicianing,
parenting.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
I do get around.
Well, let's start with the children, because everyone knows children are our future.
Someone should write a song about that.
Yeah, wouldn't that be good?
Just saying.
No, but you are doing a whole bunch of projects right now that have to do with kids.
Mm.
You're Count Olaf in a series of unfortunate events. You've written a children's book called The Magic Misfits.
Indeed.
You're hosting a show called Genius Junior.
Yes, an NBC quiz show where super smart kids face off against each other, teams of three.
God, so is there a master plan to all the kids stuff at this moment, or you think an impetus for that?
I've always been intrigued by the professionally speaking, business-wise. I think it's good to have as many demographics in play as possible, and I try to look at it from different perspectives. So doing a Smurfs movie is good twofold. One, because kids would like the movie, and there's something good about kids watching movies that are fun and that they like. But also, if it happens to be successful, then you're suddenly in a successful film, which then puts you on a smaller list of people who act in movies that make money, and that's kind of a good business play as well.
Totally.
But in doing so, then I was realizing the value of the younger market, not only business-wise, but also planting seeds for, as they get older, as, you know, some people recognize me on the street, because I'm on the street a lot. And usually it's for How I Met Your Mothers,
right?
Barney Stinson dudes. But a lot of kids are happy to see me from the Smurfs. And, like, that's a great thing to be able to have as I continue to want to work. And then my husband and I had kids.
Right.
Now I'm very interested in what they're consuming. And I want to make sure that what they're consuming is not too saucy and too adult for them. At the same time, I don't want it to be too simplistic
or pandering.
And we read a lot of books to them, and we watch movies together with them. And so that's now a constant conversation for David and I, is to I watched a ton of movies when I was growing up, and it helped me develop a sense of humor, and it helped me develop a sense of vocabulary and style. And so now I'm in a position to be able to do some of that, you know, write a book that encourages kids to celebrate their individuality, to celebrate performing, to like magic, to learn some words they might not know. And I am writing that. And so now kids can read that and theoretically ingest it. And then maybe there's more love for magic and more appreciation for kids with different backgrounds and stuff in a subtle way.
Well, it made me think as I was reading, because I'm reading out loud your book to my kids, and and they engaged and they're into it. But it got me thinking about how you know when you're writing a book, and it's not an autobiography.
Right.
Because I think everybody, at some point, if you have kids, the thought crosses your mind of, I should write a children's book, right? It seems easy, we're reading them all the time.
With the picture books especially.
The picture books especially, how hard can this be? It's Dr. Seuss, you rhyme a few lines, you draw a few pictures, million copies sold. But I wondered how you went about this, knowing, like, I know how to write to a middle school child's attention or to what they're into.
I know exactly. I mean, that was the hardest part for me of writing a middle grade book, is that our kids aren't in the middle grade yet.
Right. They're so you're not reading what they're reading, and you're
correct.
Not...
Correct. I'm having to preemptively hope that this sentence structure and these vocabulary words and this level of wit and humor is appropriate for them and is something that they'll find funny.
So how did you do it?
I'm living in Lemony Snicket land right now, right?
Right.
So I'm playing a part in a world of that's been written by Daniel Handler, who wrote 13 novels that are super bestsellers, but also gorgeous books and honoring literature and honoring the written word and using vocabulary in very clever ways. So that's been on my brain. So I was able to sort of pull from that idea.
Right.
And I also think it's important with kids that you talk to them, not at them. And I think our kids have really funny senses of humor to me. I think people want to learn, at least at that age, really actively want to learn more. So if your sentences are a little more advanced, they're excited by that because it makes them learn more. If they're real rudimentary, then I think it's a little bit boring.
Right.
So I steered a little more towards that.
Well, it's really successful because there's a story there that makes children feel smart and engaged, but it also interests adults. And I think that's not easy to pull off.
It makes adults feel like children again.
Yeah.
In a way.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's fun. It was exhausting and nerve-wracking.
And you signed up for four of them, right?
Yeah. I finished book two, so yeah. Starting on book three soon.
Well, now you can hire minions to do three and four, right? You don't need
totally.
Yeah.
Make it sound like this.
Exactly.
In an hour.
Yeah, I'll be in my trailer.
Exactly.
Well, you know, the dedication of your book is to your twins, Gideon and Harper, and you sort of call them misfits in the dedication. And I like that because it seems almost like you've managed to turn the word misfit into sort of a badge of honor, not only in the book, but by dedicating it to your kids. And I wondered if that's sort of something where, I don't know, you identify in some ways of being a misfit yourself, and that
totally.
Could be...
Totally. I think what is unique about us and what we all find uniquely weird to ourselves is what makes us fun.
Right.
Otherwise, we're all exactly the same. And I think, you know, cubicle jobs are fine, but if that cubicle lifestyle where everyone has to look the same and say the same and be in these same confines is just kind of boring. I did Rent the musical, right? I was in the second national tour of Rent. And I'm this super white kid from small town New Mexico, so that was just my upbringing. So suddenly I'm surrounded by this glorious tribe of gypsy people. Of all ages, of all sexualities, of all experiences. Some of them have lived in their car for 4 years and now are doing Rent. Some of them are from lots of money and have 15 kids and have traveled the world. I was a pig in shit. I just thought this was the coolest thing. This is what life is for, is to be around people that have stories to tell. This is the why we are doing all of this, is to try things, to have bucket lists, right? To embrace being a misfit, to love singing and fucking sing, right? Not to love singing, but only sing in the shower or in the car.
Right.
If you sing badly, who cares? One of my great regrets is that I never danced much. I was always insecure physically, because I don't know why, I just was. And at middle school dances, I would just not want to dance. I was never wanted someone to say, you know, everyone's in a circle and one person's in the middle and they're dancing around and they point to you. I did not want to be the guy that was pointed to like work my way into the middle of the circle and dance. And I regret that because dancing's amazing. And if people are going to pass judgment on you because they don't like the way you dance, that's on them. That's because they have their own dancey issues.
But it's fascinating to me to hear that it took until Rent to sort of have that explosion for you, because that was 10 years into your career of acting.
Well, I had the very random experience of starting work on film.
Instead of being in theater.
Yeah, most people start in theater. They go to college or something, and then they study Shakespeare, and they are in classes where they're supposed to pretend like they're bacon and sizzle on the ground and come out and figure out who they are. And I, was suddenly in a Whoopi Goldberg movie in Baltimore, Maryland, just randomly. It was amazing. But it's filming is, if we were trying to do this interview and I'm all over the place,
right,
they would cut and say, dude, you have to sit in the chair. We've got cameras on you.
I meant to tell you that.
Oh.
You got to stay in the chair.
Fair enough. Sorry about that. So I got pretty good from Clara's Heart, which was that movie, through Doogie Howser, which was 4 years of banging out 6-7 pages of dialogue a day with a crew. And that was amazing factory work,
right?
Because we're doing multiple 24 episodes a season, X number of hours a day. I have X number of hours of school, so I couldn't just wander in the scene.
You
I
were
could.
Structured.
It was a very structured,
yeah,
performance life. So I got really good at standing there and really aware of moving just this part of my body,
right?
Not much more than that. And there was something kind of weirdly limiting about that. You know, you befriend the camera department, you get a good friend in the focus puller if you stand still, because then they can keep you in focus.
Right.
If you're nervous and you're doing this while you're talking, the poor focus puller guy's trying to keep you in focus. The dolly grip who's moving the camera around, if you move with him, if you get up off the chair slow enough that he can do his move with you, then you get more takes that are usable. If you jump up fast, you miss the shot. So you get sort of good at moving at a pace that's effective for the scene, which is a whole different thing from existing as a person.
Right.
From dancing. So I had to sort of reverse engineer an appreciation for being proud to be free and physically and kinetic and not really caring if every shot is usable film for the editor.
Right, right, right. Well, look, I read your autobiography, and for anyone who hasn't read it, it's really cool. It's designed like the Choose Your Own Adventure,
yeah,
where it's, you know, do you go into the cave and look for the magic sea monster, turn here, or do you get on the plane and leave the island, go to this page? And I got the sense for the first time that I really kind of knew you, which even for an autobiography, a lot of times you're reading one, you feel like I'm being sold something or there's an image that's being presented. And I didn't feel like in this book there was an image that was being presented. It was almost like the construct of the book itself was the thing to present. But the stories within, I mean, there was a lot in there and a lot even in between the lines.
I've had a unique life professionally. I've had a lot of chapters and of very disparate things. I've worked as a kid. I've worked as an adult. I've worked in dramatic things. I've worked in comedic things. I've worked in live environments. I've worked as a character and also as myself. I've sang and as well as emoted, and I also have a weird, you know, within my personal life of coming out and that whole world, and that's an interesting story, I think, for some people who are looking for that as well. So I think because of that, it felt so random, all of these stories. It was hard to tie them together in a way that had any kind of linear reason.
Yeah.
So the Choose Your Own Adventure idea will fit in my life well. And also I thought it was good because if you just bought the book because you wanted to hear about Kobe Smulders being hot stories, you could just kind of go to page 104. But if you were, and then skip all the gay stuff. But if you were more interested in the, you know, how I came to be who I am stuff, then you could bypass the dumb comedy sections and just get to things that were more heartfelt. I don't know. I don't feel like it's my job as a human outside of a parent. I don't feel like it's my job to tell people of lessons that I've learned. I feel like lessons become secondary to the example that you present. Because if you say, if you tell someone a lesson, then they're just gonna hear that you're telling them that. Whereas if they figure out the lesson through some reason, that's an aha moment for them. So I'd rather use misdirection and a bit of subterfuge to get people to hear what it is I have to say than it is to stand on a box of soap.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's incredibly successful at just that. And I think that, you know, first off, the one of the first things I want to jump into on that is that I didn't realize how
gay I was.
How gay you were.
I'm no, so super gay.
No, I didn't realize the prevalence of Doogie Howser in your life for so many years after it ended. And
yeah.
You know, I spoke about this with you right before you came on, but I photographed you at the very end of your Doogie Howser run, and I tied you to a jungle gym thinking, oh, that's a good way to express visually that he may be tied to this image, much like a Kramer in Seinfeld or something like that. You know, the business won't let him move on and see him as an adult because he's Doogie Howser.
Right.
And I patted myself on the back for having a good photo idea.
For sending me to therapy for 10 years.
Right.
Thanks.
But after reading the book, I don't think it ever really occurred to me how hard that must have been to, at the age when most people are trying to develop an identity and figure out who they are, you were saddled with one that you couldn't shake. And that comes out in the book in terms of, you know, you talking about, well, Doogie's the word I heard most in my life.
Yeah.
People yelling on the streets and like, did it feel difficult to figure out who you were when that had sort of been set for you for 4 years and you couldn't escape it on the street?
Yeah, it was challenging because at that time, professionally, TV and film were so different. You had to sort of declare it. If you wanted to be on a TV show, you were a TV actor, and you didn't,
right.
You didn't work in movies. And if you were a movie person, it was very rare that a movie person would ever appear on a television episode of anything.
You never saw Lee Majors in a movie, but he was the $6 million man.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right. And so professionally, it was a little bit strange because I got this great gig and I worked hard on it and it was super fun. And when it was done, it was kind of hard to get film work or I guess more serious work from directors of import than it was to get a television movie where, which was also good work, but it was, again, it wasn't a movie, it was a television movie. So it was this
right.
weird bubble that I was in work-wise where I would love to be auditioning for action movies or for the sidekick in a adventure film, but I just wasn't going to get the gig because of the baggage that I had as a TV actor, as being a TV actor, not whether I was good or bad or whether what anyone thought of it. That was just kind of the rules then.
And not only just a TV actor, but a TV actor who was so known as one thing. I mean,
the name was its own weird thing,
right? The name was a weird thing.
Because when someone would call me, hey, Doogie, it was hard for me to know what their intention was by doing that. Do they just know me as that name? Are they saying it in kind of a low blow, I'm cooler than you, so I know that might be your Achilles heel, so
yeah.
I'll call you Doogie to power struggle the start of the conversation? Is it because they're just kind of ignorant and don't realize that I have an actual name? If I tell them that Doogie's not my name and my name's Neil, do I look like a dick?
Are you patronizing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit strange. So
yeah.
when people would talk to me as if I was that character, I didn't quite know how to be. So I lost a sense of authenticity with just being able to have a regular conversation with someone who approached me with that as the lead.
Right.
And I'd be in high school, right? I finished the show when I was 19, so instead of going to college, I just kind of chose to keep working. And I'd pass by people, groups of people my own age, and they'd say, yeah, it's Doogie Howser. And that's a very strange thing to happen because it was hard for me not to process that as a bad thing, as, oh my God.
Right, now you couldn't even feel like this is a bad thing because that's a privileged thing to say.
For sure, I had every reason to think, look at that. Look at that. They recognize me from the work I've done.
That's right.
But to me, I was, oh my God. Don't they know that I can accomplish other, have done other things, that I'm capable of other things? That's my own issue. That probably meant none of that. But that was a bit of a hard bubble. Not hard. That was just took some time of doing other things and realizing, you know, self-realization that people aren't in your own head.
Right. Well, I
learned that from going to. I've done a lot of the sort of communal self-help stuff. I did the Tony Robbins seminars, yeah. And I did the Landmark Forum and stuff. And you do realize from doing that people have their own issues and their own baggage. And no matter what it is you say to them, if they're looking at it through the lens of their own shit, then it'll be hard to be authentic with it. So if I say to someone, oh, it's nice to see, I haven't seen you in 2 years, it's good to see you, you look great, you look so fit, that's a compliment for me, but to them it might be, what, did you always think I was fat? What you think? What are you trying to say, that up until now you've always, you know what I mean? But I mean it as a compliment. So you have to just try and take things at face value, be transparent and honest and authentic with what you say, and if someone takes it the wrong way, hope that they are transparent enough to tell you that so that you can clarify yourself. But if you're too stressed about, if I care too much about what name people refer to me as, I'm spending a lot of time worrying about other people. I guess I was cognizant of that 15 minutes of fame idea that you have a singular chapter and then the wave passes by. And so you want to kind of hang on to it and extend it for as long as you can. I've said this story before, but it is a profound story for me. When I first started on the Doogie Howser Spectacular, Stephen Botchko sat me down at lunch, took me and my parents to lunch, and talked to me, as he always did, like a human person, co-worker, not like a child.
How old were you at this
point? I was 15.
Okay.
It was during the pilot. So I got the gig at the last minute, and he sat me down, and I was from New Mexico and was very, very green. And he sat me down and said, this industry is like surfing, is that you have to get on a surfboard and paddle through and wait for a long time, hoping that you catch a wave, and you'll try and catch them and you'll miss them and someone else will catch them and everyone will cheer. And eventually you'll catch a wave and you'll ride it and it'll be fantastic and you'll be really great and you'll get all the way to the end. And then the wave will inevitably crash and you'll have to turn around and you'll have to paddle back out and you'll have to get hit by waves as you get back out there. And then once you get out there, you're gonna have to sit around there for a long time waiting for another wave to come along. But the way that surfing works is that there are always sets of waves that will always come through, and that the goal is to be patient enough to value that metaphor.
Right.
And I did. So I think while I was worried that I may never work again, I managed to continue to work again. So I thought, well, I'm not getting gigs in LA. I'm only getting offered TV movies, which is not a bad thing. Once a year I would get offered great money for 4 weeks in Toronto or Vancouver to film a Christmas film or a movie where I kill my parents and with a wood mall. And I'd go and I'd meet the real kid.
I missed that one in my research.
No, it's good. And Not Our Son.
That was an actual movie.
Yeah, Not Our Son. Johnny Galecki and I.
Really?
I think that was the one, Not Our Son. It could have been the one where I was a serial arsonist.
Well, at least you had range.
Empires. But I always did kind of have that Botchko conversation in the back of my head because I desired longevity more than I desired fame. I think the immediacy of fame, although it is an opiate, is certainly double-edged. And so fame like a shooting star, which is bright but dies out, I would much rather learn how to operate a telescope so I can have some kind of perspective and sit and wait for the next chapter.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here, and if you'll lend me your ear for a minute, I want to tell you a little bit about today's sponsor, Ring. Today, over 1 million people use the amazing Ring video doorbell to help protect their homes. And Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. Ring knows home security begins at the front door, but it doesn't end there. So now they're extending that same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. And let me tell you, we just installed one of these at Off Camera, and it's kind of a great way to feel more secure about your building and know what's going on outside your front door. Just like Ring's amazing doorbell, the Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and a floodlight that connects right to your phone with HD video and two-way audio that lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. See and speak to visitors, and even set off an alarm right from your phone. With Ring's Floodlight Cam, when things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. Whether you're home or away, the Ring Floodlight Cam lets you keep an eye on your home from anywhere. Ring Floodlight offers the ultimate in-home security with high-visibility floodlights and a powerful HD camera that puts security in your hands. So folks, if you've been an off-camera listener for a long time and you're wondering, how do I support off-camera and make my home safer? Well, this is a perfect opportunity. You know, we really value our advertisers because they help us bring the show to you every week. So please, check out Ring. You can save up to $150 off a Ring security kit when you go to ring.com/off-camera. That's ring.com/off-camera. And when you put that code in, they know that you listen to us and that you check their product out. And that really helps our show. And this is a product I really believe in. So check it out. That's ring.com/off-camera. With Ring, you're always home. And now back to the show.
You know, it's funny because I'm sure you had examples, that you talk about a few in the book, of people your age that you could look around and go, oh, they're not waiting or they're not seeing the long game. You know, like you
but
talk in the book.
It's hard when you're a kid.
Right.
When you're a kid and you're on set, you get anything you want. Well, if you're an actor and you're on set, you pretty much get anything you want. There's an assistant director whose job it is to stand near you wherever you are, and if you need something, they'll get it for you. When you're a kid, that's the best thing ever.
It's pretty intoxicating.
You want a donut, they'll go get you a donut. You want a soda, the soda. And you get paid, and when you're on set, everyone's nice to you, and they laugh at your jokes and stuff. And so that's hard when you're a kid and you're working, and then everything's great, and then your show's not on the air anymore. You have to sort of redefine yourself.
You have to go to the donut shop if you want a donut.
They don't just bring you donuts anymore? Oh, it's good to know. It's funny. I was just talking to a friend about, now that I'm an adult, one of the things that bumps me is when I'm not allowed to be part of the process. I was talking to Barry Sonnenfeld, who's our executive producer and director of half the series of Unfortunate Events, and kind of my current mentor. He knows his way around a camera and a lens. He's very, very great. Has a great energy with the crew. They respect him, but they're afraid of him in the right dynamic. And he knows actors, and he knows how to be blunt with actors in a way that gets his note accomplished, but isn't mean, but is kind of mean. It's like a good balance. And he was asking me why I would want to direct. Why would you want to direct? He told me all these examples of, as a director, if you say you need 10 more days on the film, they won't give you 10 more days. As an actor, if you say, we need 10 more days, they'll move mountains to make sure that you have 10 more days. You should act in things. And I said, right, but here's the problem. As the actor, they bring you onto set, and they say, okay, quiet, everyone, the actors are on set. And they make everyone, the crew has to leave. And then the actors rehearse and quietly, and then when they're ready, then they bring the crew in, and then they show the scene, and then they want you to leave. And then they actually get to work. Then all the 40 people who are incredibly talented and skilled at what they do, moving, setting lights, adjusting things, building tracks,
sure,
fixing, painting, all of that, all the people that work,
get to work. And the actor people wander to the craft service table, are told to go to their motorhome and sit and read a book, listen to a podcast.
Right. It's almost like being put away like mannequin.
Kind of, and then a knock comes on the door, they're ready for you. And thank you, I'll be 5 minutes. And then everyone's kind of waiting. And then you come out and, I don't know, it's a weird upstairs, downstairs vibe, but I don't like it.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I said, I like to work. I love being, I love honoring that everyone's working together. It's one of my favorite things about being in theater, watching the cast of Rent. All these different people all have to, like alchemy, have to come together and do something as an ensemble. It's all right. An ensemble. Theater's fun that way because the crew guys are pulling cables while the dancers are dancing, while the orchestra is performing it. They're all doing it simultaneously. It's a little bit strange for me as an actor to be treated as if I'm on some other weird level.
Right, right.
If it's a crappy show, you still have to do the show. You can't pitch a fit and go into your trailer and call somebody and complain about it. Those actors that need to have no one look them in the eye and that need to, if someone makes a coughing sound, they can't start over, that's all super valid. And often those performances are the most miraculous to watch because by design, we watch actors act. So we're watching them, and when you're watching odd, unique, eccentric people who have this very strange process, and you're watching their process, it's exciting. I worked with Anne Haitch, who is renowned for being a little bit cuckoo. She's had chapters where she spoke to aliens, and she's done a lot of weirdness, and I did a play with her. And it was challenging for me working with Anne because she was always different. For some reason, she was not trained in theater, and she was playing someone who was being accused of being insane, a mathematician genius who was kind of crazy in the show. But I was hopeful that she would set some things so that we knew, because I was her
paramour.
Like,
you'd know she'd be here when she said that line.
Correct, or you'd know that this moment needs to become intimate. And by needing to become intimate, it should maybe be quieter and we can sort of lock that in. So then whatever happens, we know we're going to end up here. With Anne, it really wasn't like that. She would sometimes just shout everything, or sometimes I'd come in and expecting her to be there and she'd be over there. All righty. And that was, at the time, difficult for me. I wasn't a dick about it. It was just, I if anything, had more disdain because I wanted the audience, who was paying a lot of money on Broadway ticket prices, to always get the best show that we could provide.
Right.
And given that there were so many variables all the time, it was frustrating. However, I will fully say that people that saw the show thought that Anne was great in it and loved that performance, because it was always charged, right? They only sing it once. They don't know that the director told us to be sitting here at this line. So the rules are different for them, because they're not seeing it for the 10th time. They're not doing it for the 75th time. So kind of shame on me for being such a curmudgeon that I need Anne to only be here at this time. So my point with that is that while it might have been exhausting to do, it was fun to watch. And she works, and when you watch her work, there's something kinetic about it. There's something hypnotic about what she does. So both are necessary in the acting canon.
Well, I think maybe that was a pretty good education in the long run, right? To come out on stage and have to think on your feet, or have to adjust quickly on the fly. Like, did you learn from that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that was very frustrating. And then it taught me a lot. I learned, I don't have to always just do it this way. So then when I end up doing Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which is a pretty much a one-woman show, never leaving the stage, having to own this fuck you, Broadway, I should be more famous, I'm really working, living, and I'm supposed to be good, but if I'm too good, then I would be more successful, and I'm not, so I had my own thing. But I wanted to be fearless. I wanted to do things differently. I loved it when I would bang into something and start bleeding. blood was dripping down my leg. I was like, yes, this is life, live it. And I think that was fun. I mean, that's, as an actor, that is what's fun, is doing it differently as well. So,
you know, I thought of that actually, and especially after reading the autobiography later, I realized how much of a, like, it seemed like that performance changed your life in a lot of ways, or seemed like the culmination of a lot of this stuff.
It was the culmination of a lot of stuff, for
yeah.
sure. I think having hosted award shows live, that freed me up a lot in an interesting way for future stuff, because those are one-offs and you only get one chance to do it. And so you don't get to have multiple takes and multiple edits. Or on stage, if you have a crappy show, you can always go, well, I'll do better with the next show.
Right.
With an award show, you work a long time setting it up, you rehearse it for 2 days and with the whole gang, and you know exactly what's going to happen. It all kind of sort of goes that way, and that's it. Never do it again.
Right.
You know, so you do a big opening number, dancers, a whole thing, and you don't even have time to wonder how it went. You're just quickly changing into the next outfit and then introducing the next performer and then hearing that we're 2 minutes long and so we should cut this bit down and just don't do the joke. Should we do the joke? It's funny, but no, let's save it. We might use it later. Let's just do the quick read. Ladies and gentlemen, our next presenters are so-and-so and so-and-so. And then you go backstage. Okay, how much time do we save? What did they say? What did she talk about? Her shoe? Is there a shoe? Like, you're just constantly doing it for once and then it's done. You never do it again. And so that was a little freeing for future stuff.
Well, I would imagine that's the kind of thing that, you know, you would come out of the other side of one of those experiences knowing what kind of performer you are,
It kicks your ass. You work so hard trying to honor the people that are being nominated, but poking fun at them enough that it's inside baseball, but not being too mean so that they feel disrespected, and being entertaining to people that know all these people, but also trying to inform people that have never seen a show or seen this movie or this TV show what it is, so you can't. It's a very tricky gig, and then it's all done, and then no one really cared. So that was interesting perspective to have. For Hedwig, it was freeing and exciting for me to take on femininity.
Yeah.
And my own, I guess, personal sexuality nearing sort of homophobia issues that I possessed and have to take those on before I did a performance in front of a public audience, because Hedwig had already worked through all of those demons well before this show started.
So you couldn't even use that on stage. There wasn't a scene to
Correct.
Work through it. You had to sort of...
She was well beyond the, you know, do I come across too feminine? Do I, you know, is this too swishy if I sit like this? Or is, you know, there's masculine, feminine issues that we all have, men and women, about is this too girly? Is this too, you know, do I look
totally.
Too boyish? Or whatever. And so I had, that was interesting to process, and incredibly empowering once I realized that that the less I cared about it, the better it was.
Would it be fair to say that part of your research on that play was to kind of deal with your own identity and your own stuff? Like,
yeah, for sure. Well, I think for a lot of guys, it's a embarrassing, tricky situation to put on high heels and to walk around in high heels. It brings up things, you know. If you're too effective at it too quickly, are the people around you going to think, oh, look at Sam, he sure is strutting around pretty
right.
quickly, you know, and what does that mean? And if you live in it too completely, is that, are you trying, you know, I don't know, it was just weird. It brought up weird things, because I am authentically this person that I'm talking with you off camera. I don't change into some other, you know, I don't go and put on a nightie and flit around my house. And those that do, that's fantastic if that's what you want to do and that's who you authentically are. But I also don't try to butch it up in any way. And yet when I was doing Hedwig, I was having to be very, very feminine. and everything was had to be very, you know, it was very physically different, which is just a challenge.
And you hadn't been,
I'd never
that
been in drag
on camera
before.
That way either, or put that out into the world before, right?
For sure.
In a work situation.
And I didn't want to disrespect, I would say the trans community, but disrespect anyone who lives in that realm. I didn't want to do them a disservice by not committing 100% or by seeming like what I was doing was camp. I didn't want people to come and see Neil Patrick Harris in a dress as if that was a reason to sell tickets, right? Because
right.
This show was very important and had great things to say. And so to turn it into, you know, NPH does drag was so disrespectful to them and to people that do drag and to people that have real stories to tell. That it certainly didn't deserve me being stressed about coming across as too fey.
And that was your own issue to deal
with.
Of
course.
Yeah. Well, let's unpack that a little bit, because when I read the book, one of the things that really stuck out to me is that I think in one passage you used the term the miserable vortex of self-examination, that kind of in your 20s, you realized that you were somebody that would never allow yourself to maybe go too far into the partying or whatever, because you were always so aware of the way you were coming off to people. And I read between the lines that you had created a character that you were that could handle all of this. It seemed to me that you started in the public eye before you had a chance to figure out who you were. And so it's almost like...
Yeah, I didn't as a kid get a chance to be just anonymous and try different guises. I didn't go
right.
to college. I didn't get to just kind of fuck whoever I wanted or be a goth
right.
for a month or decide to just be a shithead for a while. I like that people get that opportunity to do that. To
yeah.
travel through Europe on a Europass and to see,
and not
figure out who
Doogie
they are.
Doogie in the Swiss Alps.
Yeah, and I think there's something about actors that because American at least hold them up on some sort of higher level, ready to have it crash down. You know, people like to build up the celebrity, especially say in our celebrity today with reality show actors. You love to love the housewives until they go bankrupt, and then you love to watch them go to jail. It's like that you kind
yeah.
of need this in your life. And so I think one of the, I guess, minor downsides of being an actor is that I do feel like people are kind of waiting for me to prove them right that I'm a dick. And even when I was a kid actor, you know, when they would see me...
You were self-aware enough to realize that.
Well, and maybe I was wrong, but I do still feel, and I did even more back then, feel like people are anxious to tell all of their friends that they saw some actor person at a restaurant yell at the steward, at the
sure.
manager, or don't you know who I am, someone at an airport because they don't get upgraded to first class,
or throw a phone.
People are just kind of waiting for you to really show your true colors. And I think unique to actors, I don't know what that is, because they see them performing, they assume that they're someone else in their real lives, and they hoping that they're assholes. And so they're hoping to be proved right. And so I've been, I guess, extra conscious of making sure. And I guess when I was younger, probably too much. So I didn't feel free enough to dance.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I felt like I was needing to always be aware of who was observing me and making sure that I wasn't, that I was always kind of positive. And that was its own... It hampered me in my own ways.
Yeah, you couldn't just be in the present. You had to also be standing aside, looking at your behavior and going, is that working for everybody?
Correct. And it's happened even as an adult. When kids are 2 and 3, they're crazy people, and you have to constantly reprimand them. And that gets exhausting when you're not getting sleep. And one day our kids didn't want to go to preschool, and they were crying, and they wouldn't put their coat on or whatever it was. And then, you know, just 10 times I asked them, finally it's time, we have to go, school is starting, getting out, it's freezing cold, all this stuff, Gideon just doesn't want to go, he's just standing there, he doesn't want to go, he has to go, it's time to go to school, there's no good reason why he's not. The door's open. I'm like, Gideon, we go. And he's standing there. He's crying. I picked him up by the arm. I brought him down the steps. It was snow everywhere. I put him at the bottom of the stoop. I closed the door. He's really crying because I picked him up and set him down. And I'm walking ahead of him. And I'm saying to him, cry all you want. We have got to go to school. I'm done with this, right? This is a thing I think most parents have experienced in some form or the other. Paparazzi taking pictures of all of this. So then there's a story.
Well, that's the part most parents don't experience.
Well, right, but it's kind of waiting to be confirmed that I am a dick and that I'm a terrible parent and that it's all the house of cards comes crumbling down. And so there's, sure enough, there's a story about me needing
abusive father,
needing to go to child protective services because I've snapped because I don't know what the story was. It was something awful. And they had photo evidence of me holding my child by dangling by one arm and walking, scowling in front of him while he's crying behind me. Two amazing pictures to have. So you have to be careful as an actor because you can't just be too human. But what I say is that while I do sort of feel that that as an actor person, I do need to be aware of, especially in a smart cam world, that people are observing you and your behavior a lot, and that in some ways that inhibits me being 100% free to do whatever I want. It's also probably kept me from being a dick too much, you know?
Yeah.
Like, well, in a weird way, it's been good. I actively try to be nice to people, and I would hope people would have an encounter with me and then tell their friends that I was an nice guy as opposed to a dick. And so on the one hand, it kind of sucks. On the other hand, it's probably been kind of great.
Well, I think in your 40s, there's a balance to that that's very logical and rational. But in your 20s, when you're still trying to figure out who you are, it's incredibly hard to be in the public eye. But the fact that you did take a step back and you did move out of LA and you moved back to New Mexico and took a break, but that you also went and did this Landmark Forum type of self-help thing, because I couldn't help thinking that that's the antithesis of what you're talking about. Like, I would think that you walk into some public self-help Landmark Forum type of situation and you just assume everybody in there is like, oh my God, Doogie Howser's in my self-help thing. Like, I don't know how you would...
That happened.
I don't know how you would get over the... Like, to me, it says a lot about you and that you were able to go do that in a public way to help yourself with that much higher stakes than anyone else who goes that route.
It's funny that you say higher stakes, because that's exactly how I felt when I went there. And I was very, very paranoid that everyone was overly aware that I was there. And the reason that I went there was to come to terms with the stuff that we have talked about already, with being recognized wherever I go, and the being called names that aren't my real name, and being hampered by that. Then I get there, and I'm interacting with people who stand up and say that they're a 59-year-old mother of three who's divorced. Their children don't speak to her. She was openly abused and raped by her dad for 20 years. And then someone else stands up and says that they watched their child kill themselves and then I'm sitting there going, wow.
I gotta leave right
reality
now.
Check, dude. You're here because people are recognizing you too much and calling you by a different name when these other people have some real business going on.
Like, well, when you put it that way, it seems pretty trivial, but...
No, but that was what I kind of needed to hear. Like, everyone's got their bag of stuff. And for some, it's really hardcore, and for some, it's not as hardcore, and for some, what wouldn't be hardcore to me would be super hardcore to you, right?
Right, so, right.
And professionally, though, I think it's just been, I've been lucky to have done so many different things. I do think it has provided me a perspective, at least a respect for what everyone else does around me.
Right.
When I was younger and I started acting, and I was able to have the financial ability to come to New York once a year or so and see a bunch of Broadway shows, I loved it. I loved having I loved watching people performing live, and I loved that it seemed like it was only happening that one performance to me. I really loved it when I could go backstage, meet them, see that they're normal people, and see how the sets worked. Watching the machinations of it all, was such an amazing, profound experience to me. And maybe that's because not many people get to do that.
Yeah.
When you get to go in the stage door, you're in the beyond the ropes, and now you're in the special little world. So maybe there's something special about that. But then getting to see how it all works is even more amazing. And then with magic, my love for magic may be informed by that as well, because magic is a fraternity where they keep secrets. So you don't see a magician, an illusionist, and then they don't invite you backstage and show you how the trick worked.
Right.
They keep their tricks to themselves. So then with magic, when I learn how things work and I have gotten to play in props that are deceiving and stuff, that's where I get super duper excited.
Do you think that skill from a young age in magic also made you eventually able to go deeper, to be more focused in other parts of your life?
I guess so. I guess that's a lesson I'm trying to impart on our kids as well, is that you're not going to be innately good at everything right away, and that you need to be willing to try again and to practice something. In the Magic Misfits book, the narrator talks to the reader a lot.
Yeah.
And talks a lot about, now go practice again, and when you're done, then go practice some more.
Right.
You got to honor the discipline that you're doing.
You tell a story in your book about a time you didn't honor the discipline, and that, I think it was with company.
Oh my God. Oh, that was the worst.
Is that a horrible memory?
I was asked to be Bobby in Company for 3 performances at Lincoln Center or something, and we were going to rehearse it in L.A. because I was in L.A. at the time, and I had How I Met Your Mother that I was doing, and I was busy otherwise. And so I kind of learned it. I didn't know company in and out. I sort of learned the steps, trusting that when I was going to get there, it would be fine. Well, I got there tired, hadn't learned it like everyone else had. And I'm talking, it's Patti LuPone, Stephen Colbert, Martha Plimpton, John Cryer, Jennifer Laura Thompson, some really great people. And now Neil comes in, and I'm totally not memorized. So we start with the first scene in rehearsal. And they're amazing, and they've already blocked it, and I'm supposed to know my blocking. I'm supposed to be off book. I'm not off book. I'm trying. We do it for an hour and a half or something. My brain is fried. I'm trying to remember. I'm kind of in a shame spiral because they're so much better than I am. Okay, and then we take a break. And I think, okay, I got to work on that one. And then next scene. 2 new people, talented people. It's Patti LuPone, great. Totally memorized, totally got it all. New scene, God, fuck. I have the first scene still in my brain. I'm thinking about the second scene. This goes on all day for the 2 days we have of rehearsal. Oh, it was bad. And then, and I didn't get much sleep because I was trying hard. My mind was already mushy, so I'm trying to learn stuff, but I can't really learn it at that point because it's too much information. All I needed was sleep. But if I slept, I wasn't going to learn it. So I'd try to keep learning it. I wouldn't get enough sleep. Then I'd get up, hopefully have learned it, hadn't learned it, go back. Now everyone sort of is new day. I'm still crap at it. And it was just a disaster. It was a disaster. And I was melting down. And the night before, it was bad. And the day of with the orchestra was bad. And the rehearsal with Stephen Sondheim there before the audience came in was bad. Craig Bierko is standing there, and we have a scene together, and I'm on stage with the mic, and you know, we're doing the scene, and I know it's my line, and he's looking at me, I was that guy. It was just so embarrassing. And we ended up doing it, and it ended up going surprisingly okay. I had lines written on props and things that I needed to use.
Did you really?
If I had to, I would use them if I needed to. But I got through it.
Like, there's some things, no matter how far you get in your career or how successful you get, you can't cheat the work, right?
Well, when you're fucking standing on stage at Lincoln Center with a discerning crowd filled with people like Stephen Sondheim himself, and you're trying to sing lyrics to a song that are really repetitive but different, Somebody hold me too close, somebody hurt me too deep is one time, and the other time it's someone who'll hold me, you know, the incremental changes. That was really challenging because I didn't want to fail him, and I didn't want to fail. And I was real close to failure in front of a lot of people who would recognize said fail, not a crew of people who would say, it's okay, bud, you know, we'll do it another take.
Maybe you need one of those things every now and then to, like, wake you up a little bit.
Yeah, I don't want to be that guy that walks through stuff. If I'm going to commit to something, I want to give it. I want to do better than you expect.
Right. There's a, and I'm sorry I keep going back to the autobiography, but I feel like it was in its own random way, sort of an organization of your life of becoming an artist. And you said a line in there. You said it wasn't until I laid all my cards on the table that the opportunities really opened themselves up to me. And I think what you were referring to is until I started being myself in public and in private with my parents and my loved ones and coming out and accepting who I was, that I really got to flourish as an artist and do my best work and have opportunities to do my best work. Mm. And I got the sense that it wasn't until you figured out that it was okay to totally be yourself that the career really blossomed. I mean, is there truth to that?
I was just pretty guarded as a person. I was very aware of others around me and how they were observing me. So it wasn't that I didn't think I would work if I was more honest about sexuality stuff or behavioral stuff.
Right.
It was just that I was worried about what other people would think. And so I realized that the notion of uniqueness, of being a misfit, is what is exciting about people. When I interact with someone and I leave the conversation and find them a bit guarded, I think something's up with them. I think that there's something that they're hiding or that they're not telling me, and therefore I'm not as engaged with them.
Yeah.
Where I'd rather hang out with someone who's messy and all over the place, because at least then I can get a read on them and think they're hilarious. So it's what makes you unique. It's what makes you complete when you're able to be who you are, because who you are is great. I think gray hair is fantastic. I think birthmarks are amazing. I think tattoos are pretty cool. I don't think people need to be worried about acceptance, because everyone's worried about acceptance.
Right.
So if we're just always worried about being accepted all the time, you kind of got to accept yourself. And that's a good place to start, right? So certainly with the gay conversation, I don't think that people need to be as judgmental about others regarding stuff. I don't think that there's a singular right way to exist and be. And so I think we have had too much of that, of if you don't follow this belief, you're wrong and you're bad, because everyone has their own paths. And I love watching people who are super cool with all of it. Some of my best favorite friends are married straight couples, and they're super okay with the gay, with the flirty, with the fun, with the sass. It doesn't affect their masculinity at all, and they're just super, they know the person, the soul behind it. And I think that's a much healthier place to be than hey bro, hey easy,
totally
easy guy, yeah, I'm not like that, not like you guys. I don't know, that just seems stupid to me.
Yeah,
I
no,
feel like you gotta be yourself. Why do you go to the circus, man? To see people do crazy shit,
right?
You don't go to the circus.
Well, that's
to watch
why we
everyone.
Go to the movies. It's why we do almost anything. And that's right. I think there's a gulf between sometimes, I don't know, the kid that wished he would have danced more. And I think we all are observing ourselves to some degree. And I think that the leaders, especially the artists and the people that are doing things that we all wish we could do or that we all watch, that we can't take our eyes off of, those are people that at one point had to make a decision. Am I going to be myself and say, doesn't matter what anyone thinks? Like, I think it takes that to make something truly great. And that's the thing I think I took away from this last week of sort of getting into your life.
I like doing bucket list fun things. And professionally, I like to do challenging things that you might not expect, that I might not expect. And in my personal life, I like to do crazy things that I haven't done before. And I want to be proud of myself, you know? And so all the cards kind of need to be on the table. We're not all perfect people, and I'm certainly not a perfect person. And that's what makes me me. So, yes, agreed. It's hard to not self-regulate a fair amount.
Yeah.
But I think we should honor our differences. That's why I'm glad to be an actor, because you get to be creative and you get to hide in guises and you get to vanish and return. And you can say what you want and feel kind of how you want. I wish everyone could be that way. But I like being a storyteller. I like being able to write a book for kids that is a world that they can escape to, that's designed by me to teach lessons in a subtle way. I like directing things. I like producing magic shows that people can come and see for the sole reason of enjoying it. And all are welcome to my carnival. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whether it's a magic show or a Netflix show or a movie or a book or an award show, I am a bit of the court jester, even though I may have a couple interesting things to say. And I feel very fortunate that I'm in a position to be able to tell lots of interesting stories.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, 5 years ago, I couldn't have imagined the projects that you're doing now, and 5 years before that. I mean, one thing that's for sure, in 5 years, you're going to be doing something that probably none of us imagined. And I think that's the best way to live your life as an artist, is to keep on challenging yourself or keep on trying different things. And honestly, if you would have told me at the beginning of How I Met Your Mother that you were going to be Hedwig on stage on Broadway, to look back on a life like that, that's something to be proud of. So
thank you.
Thanks for opening up a little bit and sharing this.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
Hey, folks, that's our show for today. And that concludes our year. But I have good news. We are coming right back after the new year with more new episodes of Off Camera. While we're away, you can dive deep into Neil Patrick Harris's work. You can read The Magic Misfits to your children. You can watch A Series of Unfortunate Events on Netflix. You can stream all 207 episodes of How I Met Your Mother. Or you can just type in Neil Patrick Harris into YouTube and prepare to be blown away. I would recommend starting with the 2013 Tony Awards if you want to see just what this man is capable of. And I want to thank him for being the final guest of the year. And I want to thank you, the listeners, for sticking with us on this show. You know, Neil's episode is the 129th episode of Off Camera. And if you told me when I started this that I would still be doing it 129 episodes later, I would be blown away. It's been such an incredible experience to sit down with these iconic artists and pick their brain for hours and hours about everything related to their process, to their creative path, to their fears and failures, and to their unique ways of approaching their own careers. And I hope the pearls of wisdom, the stories, the anecdotes have been as valuable to you as they have been to me. I hope to keep doing this show for a long, long time, and I appreciate all of you coming on this journey with me. If you want to dig deeper into the journey of Off Camera, go to offcamera.com. There you'll find access to all 129 episodes of the show via our Off Camera monthly subscription. For those of you who just listen to the show as a podcast, that's great. We love having you along. But you should also know that we are a 4K HD, glorious black and white television show as well. And by watching these shows visually, you can get right inside the mind of these iconic artists. And it's a great way to experience Off Camera. And for only $4.99 a month, you can watch every show as many times as you want on any device you want. What I'm saying is Off Camera is a great way to spend the holidays, and if you've had a little bit too much of your relatives or your mother-in-law, take Off Camera into the bedroom, close the door, and get some wisdom from these creative geniuses. Also, just in time for the holidays, you can pick up a copy of our brand new book, Off Camera, The Portraits. It's 275 pages of beautiful black and white imagery, and it's a great way to get an even more expanded portrait of every artist that has been on the show. And if you order right now, you can get one of our signed editions. And when you enter the code OCBOOK at checkout, you can get another 10% off. It's a great gift to either someone you love or for yourself, and it's a great way to support Off Camera. So again, it's offcamera.com. Click on the store, and you'll find all sorts of cool gifts in there. I want to thank everyone that works on the show. We couldn't do a show without all of these people. They're invaluable to us, and I want to wish them all happy holidays and tell them to get right back to work because we have more shows to do. That's Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Laura Kemper, Michaela Galvin, Amy Jones, Kara Johnson, and a special shout out to Matt Davidson, who has a nasty bout of bronchitis, so get well soon, Matt. If you want to find us on social media, we are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram, and my email is sam@offcamera.com. So email me if you have a guest suggestion or comments or criticisms or a good eggnog recipe, anything you want to send me. It's been a great year. I want to thank you all again for listening. I hope you come back and join us next year. And everyone here at Off Camera wishes all of you a safe and happy holiday. See you next time, Off Camera.